Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome to episode 29 of the Going Deeper podcast. My name is JD, and I'll be your host today as we discuss a lesson that we did on Sunday around the film A Wrinkle in Time. Dad gave us a lesson on that on Sunday about the idea of living with courage. And so this morning we have some people here to talk about the film and to enjoy some conversation. With me today is Jeff.
Good morning.
And Mary Jean.
Good morning, everyone.
And today we have a special guest for everybody. Her name is Annie Rankin. Annie, hello.
Good morning, everyone.
Now, Annie has a master's degree in film studies and actually teaches film classes at Southern State. Annie, why don't you just tell us a little bit about that experience?
Okay, sure. Well, as you just mentioned, JD, I've been teaching film classes at Southern State now for, I think it's about 10 years. And I'm now in my 11th year of teaching at the college. But I began teaching intro to film. And that course was actually originally written by another faculty member who has a faculty emeritus who has retired. And once he left, I looked at the course, and courses change over time. And so it was more like a lit and film course, and I wanted it to be focused more on analysis, if you will. So when we went through semester conversion some years ago, I rewrote the course to be more of a formal analysis course. And then most recently, I wrote a course, Film History, and I teach both of those, both face-to-face and online, cool. In addition to teaching other English courses, composition and literature and so forth.
Awesome. So what was it that led you to study film, and why do you enjoy that medium so much?
Well, two things. I was fascinated with film from the first moment I saw film. I can recall the first film I saw at the drive-in theater, Roselawn Drive-In Theater, many years ago. It was Where the Red Fern Grows.
Oh, wow.
But then I just became hooked on film, I think, more so than probably at the average child. I don't know whether that was good or bad. But some fond memories of watching Shock Theater, it was called back in the day, and other things. But what led me to study film, and I tell my students this, it merges two of my favorite art forms, the fine arts and literature. Mm-hmm. But of course, film is its own medium. So it is I don't want to get too much into a lesson here, but film is both a temporal and spatial art form, whereas art is typically considered a spatial art form and literature a temporal, and over time. One cannot capture an entire poem, story, novel in one setting or one glance, whereas you can for a fine artwork such as the one that's on the wall here. Yeah. But with film, it is both temporal and spatial because it occupies a frame. So we study the concepts of fine art from the film frame, but it's a moving frame. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, it's temporal because it takes time to capture the film. So, and yet it's its own. Because, again, it is also a multi-track medium. So you're getting sound, you're getting picture, you're getting movement and what have you. So I tell my students it merges two of my favorite forms, but yet at the same time it's its own form. Mm. So
Now, one of the things that you've been doing over the course of this particular series, the God on Film series, is sitting down with Dad and I during the week of the lessons that we're teaching to just kind of talk about the major themes of the film. Just give us a sense of your experience doing that, and what was fun about that for you?
Well, it was very fun, I'll have to say. I hope it's been fun, and well, more important, I hope it's been insightful.
It has been helpful
for the two of you and for the lessons, hopefully. But it's interesting too. It was educational for me as well, because I get to see a little bit of how then you take the ideas and the themes from these films and take the biblical principles and apply those. In other words, even though the film itself is many of them, certainly not godly in nature, but you know what I mean, or not what we would term Christian, though we have done,
sure,
I believe, Christian films in the past. But regardless, these are issues that we face as human beings. Mm-hmm. And members of the human race. And so taking those issues and then going back to God and saying, okay, God has an answer for this, I think has been not only enlightening, but certainly insightful from my perspective. And I also get to see how each of you works. Mm-hmm. I like to see, well, and Mary Jean can probably add into this, being a teacher, it's fascinating to see how your process works. And so, and again, and I'm learning. So when I'm meeting with the two of you and then I sit Sunday and see these lessons, I think, wow, I'm always fascinated by with the information, because again, you two obviously have your own that you've pulled from the film, and then what you take from that. I'm just fascinated by that. Mm-hmm. So it's been a learning experience as well. Very insightful for me.
Cool. It's been fun sitting down with you, because one of the interesting things about having a real film analyst actually sit down and walk through these issues with us. I know when we did the Incredibles film, you and I sat down to talk about that, and there were things you were pulling out that honestly I hadn't even thought about, or moments that I did not recall, because you kind of sit down, you blast through a movie, and you catch the things you catch. But what was interesting is the pages and pages of notes you had on those films, and it was obvious you're working through films. I'm sure at times you sit down and enjoy a film with like the family or whatever, but for you it's really a work process in a lot of ways.
It's funny you say that, because with my students, one of the points of intro to film we say is to take student from being the passive viewer to an active viewer, or excuse me, an active reader of film. Mm. And yes, it is difficult. And my husband will tell, if you speak with him, and my son, Grant, he has that same process, if you will. When he watches a film, he's reading it as he's watching it. And so, yes, my husband will say, I can't even watch a movie anymore. You two are just sitting there talking. But I guess it seems natural. So if that's the case, that's good. But yes, anytime I watch a movie, I'm taking notes, or I'm mentally taking notes, and then I want to go back. But that's fun for me. Mm-hmm. I know. Well, it's fun in the many ways that each of you does his or her work and say, oh, but at the same time, it doesn't even feel like work. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
I thought one of the things that made an impression on me is the movie Adrift. Mm. And you saw things in that movie that I never caught. Like the one point you made, that when they did close-ups on her face in the background, he's not on the back of the boat. And I never picked up on that at all. It's like, okay, you're watching this movie at a much different level than I did. Because you're right, I'm more of a passive observer typically when I go to the movies, other than God on film. I'm more analytical there, but typically when I go to the movies, I go to escape. To sit back and, let a story take
hand
me.
Hand in a bag of popcorn.
Well, yeah. That's big.
Think if I have to.
Yeah.
That's one of the challenges in the classroom, is to tell the students, and I don't want to take that experience away from them, because that is film. It is largely an escapist form, and directors know this, writers know this, and it's also it's more of a business now, mm-hmm. And making money, but not that you don't still have those directors that at the same time, of course, want to create an
great
individual
art.
Work of art. But, mm-hmm. And I don't want to take that away from students, but they do tell me, I can't even watch a movie anymore. And, of course, I'm thinking, good. But at the same time, no, one can still enjoy a film. But it's difficult not to pay attention to, if I start to identify patterns as they're going off, whether it's an editing pattern, shot patterns, and so forth, I'm immediately going, okay, what's this about? And
what's
so
the purpose?
It triggers, yeah.
Why
it triggers
are they trying
my thought.
To do that?
My wheels start spinning, mm-hmm. I guess. But
I want to go back and watch Adrift now and look mm-hmm. at that scene again,
yeah.
because I didn't notice it either.
But yeah.
Well, we're excited about having you here today, Annie,
to talk about
A Wrinkle in Time. Now, before we get to that, we did have. By the way, Annie. I haven't gotten to ask you this. We've been asking everybody that's joined us through the course of the podcast process. What's one of your favorite God on film movies that we've covered over the years. We've been doing this for a little while.
Well, thank you for saying one of, because like most of you, I think it's difficult to pin down a favorite. Sure. However, I will have to say one of my favorites would probably be The Incredibles 2, mm-hmm. from this year's lesson. Just because when the first one came out, I know my family and I enjoyed that so much. And this one, like the first one, packed with any number of potential analytical possibilities. And you and
sure.
I talked about that.
Yeah.
And you had the biggie. I mean, mm-hmm. I thought, again, to try to pin down, not taking anything away from all that Jeff has done, but, you know, so many potential themes and so many different ways to go with that movie. And yeah. so to pin one down, I thought was rather challenging.
Yeah. There's a lot going on in that movie.
Yes.
It really was. So many subplots.
Yeah. and possibilities, and particularly the theme of media in this one,
mm-hmm.
because you and I talked about that a little bit. But yes, right.
The whole screen slaver bit. Yeah.
Yes, but it's my favorite. I love Craig Nelson and Holly Hunter and Samuel L. Jackson. I mean, their voices is just...
Perfect.
Yes, that. Yes.
Yeah. All right. Now, so we did have a question come in from one of our esteemed listeners. This, of course, comes from our illustrious friend of the podcast, Russ Boone, and he wrote an email that I think is worthy of some discussion. He said, "Jeff, at the beginning of the pod, of the lesson on Sunday, you referenced three things that cause us to behave in courageous ways: anger, fear, and love. I'm assuming you left off the fourth thing that causes courage for the sake of time. I look forward to you addressing liquid courage in the Going Deeper podcast. Just trying to be a blessing, Russ." Liquid courage, go.
Oh, my. Only Russ.
For those of you that are listening, I did not vet that before the podcast began rolling. Dad is responding to this in the moment.
I'm speechless. I have no comment. Russ got me with that one.
Mary Jean, you got anything you want to throw?
Just
in?
When you said Russ Boone, we were all shaking our head. No, no comment.
Let's don't go there.
Yeah.
I will say this. I think Russ has asked a question that's worthy of at least some mild discussion. The reality. I think when you bring up liquid courage, I think Annie was over there just holding up her coffee cup, going coffee. You know, like yeah,
it's my liquid courage.
There we go. Obviously, Russ referring to slightly harder beverages, I believe. But really the adulteration of courage, when you think about it, giving you a courage that you do not naturally possess.
A false courage.
A false mm-hmm. courage, so to speak. That rather than, because of most of the examples that you gave on Sunday, you talk about guys running into burning buildings, people like a woman whose child trapped under a car, lifting it up and throwing it off, the courage to wade into a difficult relational situation, the courage to, raise a difficult child, the courage to, stay connected and committed to a marriage for the long term, all the things actual courage driven by love, which was really the point that you were making on Sunday. However, adulterated courage can really be devastating when you think about it, because rather than causing you to make good decisions, in many cases it causes you to make really poor ones.
Yeah.
Oftentimes with long-term lasting negative consequences.
True. Attorneys make a lot of money off of people
who make decisions under the influence
of liquid courage.
counselors,
that I know from experience.
Counselors too, as a matter of fact, spend a lot of time working with individuals who were coming from the court as a result of choices made under certain chemical influence.
I do remember at one point I kind of kept track when I was doing a lot of criminal defense work. And somewhere in a neighborhood of 80 I remember it was between 85 and 90% of my caseload was alcohol driven. To some degree, whether it was domestic violence or assault or you name it, alcohol showed up in the case.
Because it gets rid of that voice inside your head that said, "Hey," says, "Hey, that's enough." You know,
that's stupid.
That's stupid. I mean, even because a lot of times, you know, it is justified anger, but you have to know when to pull that justified anger back. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think that's the key there.
Mm-hmm. And that, Russ, is why I didn't go there.
Russ, thank you. That was insightful moment of conversation there. Really feel like it added something this morning. Want you to know, we appreciate your continual support of the podcast, and we hope that you come at us with further insightful bits of discussion material as time goes along.
Do all not right. encourage him.
I wonder what Darlene's thinking at this moment. That's the big question.
I think Russ probably is proud of what he's accomplished this morning.
Absolutely. His wheels are turning.
He's just looking forward to the next installment of God on Film, I'm sure. As you went through the lesson, Dad, the question we ask often, was there anything that you felt like you weren't able to really cover over the course of the lesson that you feel like has a meaning and value for us as we kind of think through this film and we think through the idea of living with courage based on love?
Well, I think one of the really interesting aspects of the movie and the book as well that I just didn't have time to fit in here. And I really went in a different direction, so it would not have fit with this lesson. But you could do a whole different lesson on it. Is this idea that came through loud and clear that each of the characters had a weakness. And that weakness came out in the film.
The character flaw.
The character flaw that either drove them to choose poorly or, in the case of Meg, ended up becoming a strength. For example, Charles Wallace. Here you have this child who's a genius and who obviously has a lot going on, and yet pride was his weakness. Mm-hmm. And so he's overtaken by the it essentially because of his pride. The father character. He gets himself into trouble because he is so enamored with the idea of taking his research to its ultimate limit that he makes a choice that takes him away from his family for 4 years. And you see it really clearly in the movie because there's that moment when he's about to step through that thing they call a tesseract, which teleports him to another planet. There is a moment where he's looking at his wife rocking their baby, and yet he steps through it. And these choices that these characters make, they make based on flaws in themselves. Mm. And the interesting thing about Meg is that she becomes very aware of her flaws and shortcomings and the wounds that she has, especially the wound of her father leaving, and she doesn't know why. And of course, as with any child, she has those questions. Was it me? Was there something wrong with me? Mm-hmm. And there's an interesting line in the movie. It says, "The wound is where the light enters." Mm-hmm. And I just thought that was a cool moment that I wish I had had more time to go into, but she was very wounded by what her father had done, and it played out in her anger at school and all these other situations that she had that she was getting in trouble about. But really, that wound is where the light could also enter, because she could identify with others who are wounded, and she could identify with her little brother which was really cool. I mean, it was a neat aspect of the movie that I just didn't have time to go into. Hmm. But you think about it. I mean, Annie brought it up earlier. The Bible says, you know, pride goes before a fall. And that's what you see in Charles Wallace, the little brother. You know, he thinks he can handle the it on his own. Mm-hmm. Wrong. Mm-hmm.
Annie, what did you notice about those characters and their flaws kind of in the film? What jumped out at you about those characters and how their flaws kind of created their struggles along the way?
I'm going to touch on what Jeff was just saying about Charles Wallace for a moment there. And, you know, I look at the fact that, and I'll get back to that. I'm sorry, my mind's kind of spinning right at the moment. But I'll start with, yes, his pride, thinking, pride combined with naivety, I guess, because he is so young. Mm-hmm. And his genius can sometimes make even adults forget, and I'm speaking of the adult characters within the film, perhaps forget his inexperience.
And he's a child.
And naivety. Hmm. And certainly that's a metaphor, or one could say that's a metaphor, because often, just like in The Incredibles that we talked about, you know, the children, again, these magnificent gifts, yet not really at a stage where they are prepared to use them wisely, and mm-hmm. we're all there, you
express
know, obviously.
Great control of it.
Correct. Yeah. And at different stages in our lives and certainly in our Christianity. So here is Charles Wallace, and I think, oh my, in so many ways, we as humans think we can take on what is put before us. And if you look at that graphic in the film, you know, this CGI creature, and yet we don't necessarily see what's before us as that overwhelming, and yet it is. Mm-hmm. And when we think we can take it on, that in that case, bravado, we were talking about all this courage that we think we have, but yet it's not real, mm-hmm. real courage. If we don't equip it with God mm-hmm. and the Word of God, then what's going to happen? You know, mm-hmm. we're easily, you know, the forces are, and the devil is too crafty. Mm-hmm. So yes, I thought that was interesting, because here's this, again, this young Charles Wallace, that even the person as probably maybe as experienced or intelligent, smart, what have you, but it doesn't mean one can't fall if one isn't wise to, or perhaps not taking on what one is faced with or what one might face without looking to God, because mm-hmm. we cannot do it without God. Meg, yes, as Jeff, as you mentioned, now that's a case where your flaws can also, if used wisely, can become a strength, or what mm-hmm. maybe the world sees as a flaw. God says, you know what, I can take your junk mm-hmm. and I can turn it around yeah. and I can use it for good. And that's what I see in Meg's character. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's, you know, you've said that in lessons and so forth. And, you know, even in my own life, and I won't go into that, but in going back to where the wound is, where the light enters. And that's a tricky portal, isn't it? Because with that wound, we can go one of two ways, and we can go back to the liquid courage. It's interesting that Russ brought that up today. Because if you treat it with liquid courage, yes, you're going down the rabbit hole. You're going mm-hmm. the wrong way. Mm-hmm. But if you allow the light in and allow God in, it will go the better path, or the right path. And mm-hmm. and Meg chose the love path and the light path, even while she's consumed in this darkness. Mm. So,
What do you think it is, guys, about how our character flaws impact our ability to display courage? So these characters all had a flaw, but the lesson's really about courage. How do those flaws impact our ability to display courage?
I think, you know, it's seeing your flaws and admitting your flaws. That's when you have to depend on God and others. I mean, I think that's when you finally come around to accept that is my flaw. You know, I can't do this without somebody else because I can't do it, whether it be, you know, a buddy or, you know, helping me through something. But it all comes back to I can't do it alone. Mm. You know, I have to have somebody who has that strength.
Mary Jean, thank you for bringing that up, because in the film, if we see it, that yes, while Meg had that and she had the light and the guidance of the three misses, okay, but she also had her, well, finally at that one point, her father and Calvin, well, and, you know, her brother, Charles Wallace, up until she had to go and fight for Charles Wallace on her own, but she had that support. I think that is key. I certainly don't want to make, I don't want to not emphasize that, yes, we need God, but of course, God also puts before us brothers and sisters in Christ, and we need those relationships to get through that. So, Mary Jean, thank you for. Mm-hmm.
And he tends to put people beside us that
yes.
support and help us through those weaknesses.
Absolutely.
I mean, so, you know, sometimes I look at some of my best friends and they're so different than I am.
Sure.
Well, the reason they are is because they need me and I need them to, you know, take care of those holes that we have.
Yeah, indeed. The classic scene, I thought this was really well done, is Meg is asking basically what Calvin brings to the table. Mm-hmm. Why he's going
yes.
with us.
Mm-hmm.
And Charles Wallace says he has, or one of the misses, I can't remember which, say, well, he has the gift of diplomacy. Mm-hmm. Meg's response is, why do we need that?
Yeah.
And
the
another,
answer.
And one of the other characters says, the fact that you're asking the question
yeah, exactly. you know,
means that we need that gift.
Enough you know,
said, yes.
She
didn't get it. You know, mm-hmm. And it was just, it was classic, because a lot of times God puts people around us that have those things that we don't even realize we need.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
But mm-hmm. he knows.
Yes.
And he knows our weaknesses.
Mm-hmm. What strikes me is that those flaws are where we have the greatest likelihood of turning inward. Mm-hmm. Right. That flaw is the place where we are most likely to act selfishly, which is the core base of the darkness. Is that mm-hmm. not, you know, mm-hmm. from the film, like that's the idea of the darkness, is that it's selfishness and hate and all of those things. And where we are flawed is where we are often most tempted to choose that. And so it flies in those flaws fly in the face of courage. And combat our ability to behave courageously, because they're by their very nature self-motivated and self-centered.
And I think self is the key, and I believe self is the key to if all sin. I mean, because
sure,
that's when we're trying to protect ourselves and not let other people see that flaw in us, or not willing to depend on someone else to help us in those areas that we need help. I think it all goes back to self. And when we become self-oriented, that's when we let the it in.
Well, and the embodiment of that would be most likely the father character that you were just talking about, mm-hmm. Jeff, that yes, it, given that choice, well, I'll take this risk because what I desire is greater than what I'm looking at. So, he is that embodiment, if you will, I think, of what you were just mentioning, JD. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I thought, you know, he makes that choice, and then in that scene where Meg first finds him, and he doesn't even realize he's been gone 4 years, and you think mm-hmm. you mm-hmm. think about the impact on a child.
Yes.
For you to just, the father figure to just disappear out of their life for 4 years. I mean, that's huge. Mm-hmm. And yet, he took that risk.
Yes. And he's, you know, where they're going down that tunnel and he's just trapped there. And yes, almost as if the same as when he left. So again, if we think metaphorically, you're still trapped in that sense of self, unaware of, and of course he was in that sense in the film actually unaware of it. But if we think figuratively unaware, when we're absorbed with self, we kind of put ourselves in this tunnel, and so we don't see, we choose not to see then what is around us and before
the
us.
Impact on others,
the impact,
sure.
Go ahead.
And I really thought that the way the book comes across and the movie as well, in a sense, Meg becomes almost a Christ figure.
Yes.
Because that statement she makes at the end, you can hurt me, but I will still love you. And I mean, she's getting battered, you know, terribly by the it, and yet she's going to take it. Not knowing, you know, if she's going to die from it. I mean, she's going to do whatever it takes to save Charles Wallace. And I just thought that was really cool, the way they brought that off.
Indeed. And even as her father, again, this just now is coming to my mind as you mentioned that, because you and I had talked about her being a Christ figure. And when he said no, no, and he was trying to pull her away, I think of the temptation, yes, trying to pull Christ away from his what he knew he needed to do, which was be crucified. And the father, no, no. And she's like, no, I have to go. And we talked about the Christ figure, and I won't go into too much detail here, but what made me think of was even if not a Christ figure, but I think she is a Christ figure, but she's that journey. There was a type of criticism called archetypal criticism, and I won't go into all of that, but Joseph Campbell, who had written The Power of Myth and that was his interview with Bill Moyers, but The Hero with a Thousand Faces, he talked about the journey, the monomyth, the hero's journey. And one of those, he looked at different figures throughout literature and, of course, looked at Christ. And, one of the aspects of the hero journey is going into a world of supernatural wonder and overcoming an insurmountable, if you will, obstacle, seemingly, and yet coming back and returning to that same world from which the character had come. And, you know, there's different stages of feast and what have you. But I thought certainly she's a Christ figure, but in addition, one could say she was taking that journey. And that's one of the things that came to my mind, because again, yes, she's going into this supernatural world. And that's what differentiates, if you will, a hero from a protagonist, because a protagonist is just a central character, whether or not he or she has heroic characteristics or is on a hero's journey. But I see Meg as, yes, that is clearly a hero journey, and one that is the Christ journey. There's also the Dionysus journey and Narcissus journey. You know, there are several, but that was the Christ journey that Campbell had written about. So,
Now, as we kind of wrap up, I feel like one of the cool things about the lesson was that you gave us four main ideas about what courage based on love would allow us to do, right? It would allow us to assume significant or dangerous risk, face the unknown, endure great hardship, and overcome my weaknesses. I want to think in terms of our own individual lives and how we operationalize that kind of courage, because I think it's one of the challenges about film is stories like that are by nature big, right? Mm-hmm. Nobody's time traveling in Hillsborough, Ohio. Nobody's facing down a giant, you know, forming wall of darkness that is not metaphorical, right? You know, our lives feel very different than the films we enjoy, the books we read. Even I think what's dangerous about the Bible for those of us that are reading it, you know, millennia later, is that it can feel mythic and not real, right? It can feel like, oh, this is the great story about Noah, the great story about Moses, the great story about Jesus, but my life isn't like that. We can very easily, you know, fall into that trap. So how do we operationalize courage based on love in our lives? How do we do it? Right?
I think for each of us, you know, one of the big metaphors in the movie is this idea of light and dark, mm-hmm. and pushing back the darkness. And I think each of us in our own life have to look at the light that we're shedding wherever it is, whether it's in our home with our children, raising up the next generation of light bearers, or whether it's at work and how we perform our work in a way that brings the light, you know, into a dark world. You know, as you said, no, we're not teleporting to other planets, but if we are pushing back the light or pushing back the darkness right where we are, that in itself, to me, is mythic.
Mm-hmm.
I think you've said it in a nutshell, because we are constantly bombarded by darkness.
Mm.
And it, all the aspects of the darkness, the it, and beyond that. It's around us. It's everywhere we look. And, you know, we can go into any number of potential subjects of you know, like you said, if you're raising your children or even yourself trying to live a godly life.
Because there's the evil within, too. I mean, there's, you know, there's, it's not just the external evil. It's the evil we create.
And I think that evil and that darkness is the one that's the hardest to combat, that darkness within you.
Back to the pride and
the self. Requires probably the most courage, right?
Yes.
To actually face down and know yourself.
Very good. Thank you for emphasizing that, JD. That in addition to that external darkness, yes, it's because I think of the flesh. We talk about the flesh and the spirit, right? And the, how weak the flesh is. And Paul warns us about that. Mm-hmm. And that the flesh and the spirit are always in that battle. And yes, we're in this flesh shell. And so the spirit is constantly, you know, there's that constant battle within ourselves. And you add to it all those external factors. And wow, it becomes, I mean, even though we're looking at the film and yes, there's that it, and but wow, it can feel like that a lot of the time.
Right.
That we're getting battered and bruised, like Meg was getting battered and bruised. So, yes, the steps that Jeff mentioned, the again, facing the unknown, assuming risks, enduring hardships, and overcoming the weaknesses, it's with God and with, His Word and our Christian brothers and sisters. I know I'm simplifying that, but if constantly equipping oneself, and I'll go back to Paul, you know, about standing and going in, using that armor, if you will, to combat the darkness that we face in our lives and within our own, within ourselves.
So would it be fair to say if you act with love in any situation, that is courage? Just that very act of being loving, being Christ-like, living with that is courageous action, pretty much regardless of the situation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I think sometimes we tend to put courage in a category that it has to involve something that is life and death at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And that
no
courage is getting up in the morning and going to work when you really don't want to. But you know, you have a family to support and you have a job to do and people that depend upon you. And courage is making those hard day-to-day choices that really, you know, require you to live out your faith. is a little bit like, and maybe this isn't really an exact analogy, but I remember somebody once making the comment to me, you know, that everybody thinks Romeo and Juliet is this great love story, right? Mm-hmm. Because they're so madly in love with each other that when their families, you know, are feuding and all this kind of stuff, they kill themselves. That's a great love story. Somebody said, how much greater of a love story would it have been if the story focused on their 10th anniversary and what they had endured to remain together regardless of what was going on around them? Okay, that would be courage.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
To live out your love despite the fact that your families are at war with each other, and to set an example of light in that dark family circumstance.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's courage.
Yes.
It doesn't take any courage to drink poison.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think when we're talking about pushing back the darkness, sometimes that's just as simple as not gossiping. That darkness might be the gossip of the day, you know, or something like that. I mean, that darkness is not always come in the frame of the big evil,
the it,
you know. Sometimes it comes across, that darkness is a very innocent phone call or a very innocent interaction. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, that's there. Mm-hmm. It's there, you know, and to push back on those little daily things is sometimes, like you said, that's the true test. You know, the big things, that's easier. It's that little daily, the daily things, the daily it's that you face. That's tough.
I think you hit on something really important there, because the big things, you see them coming.
Mm-hmm.
They're obvious, so they get your attention.
And get your warriors beside you, you know?
Yeah. It's those little intrusions of the darkness on a daily basis that sometimes can cause great good if you don't deal with them in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Well, guys, I think this has been a really fun and good discussion. I appreciate you guys jumping in and helping us out as we wrap it up today, guys. We really appreciate you guys listening, and we really appreciate questions even from Russ. And and so if you have a question about any of the things that you heard today, or you have a question about any of the scriptures or anything else that were quoted in this particular lesson, or you want just some more information, we would welcome your feedback on that. You can send us an email at info@goodnewsgathering.org, or drop a communication card in the jars in the back of the auditorium on your way out on Sunday, and we'll be happy to address that during the course of these podcasts. These podcasts are a lot of fun to do, but they're even more fun when we get input and feedback from you guys. So please feel free to weigh in, and we will have fun discussing what you send to us. Again, thank you guys very much for joining us today, and we appreciate you and hope that you have a great day. We'll talk to you later.
Have a great day, everybody.
Enjoy your week.
Yes, take care.